From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Reporter at CNN Politics. And here are the issues. The nuclear deal with Iran passed the magic number of 34 supporters in the U.S. Senate, meaning that opponents of the agreement lack the necessary votes to block implementation of the accord. Saudi King Salman is on his first official visit to Washington, where he's expected to discuss the Iran deal and its implications for other regional conflicts, including wars in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. And in Europe, the refugees from those wars keep coming, flooding into the continent by boat, train, and even on foot. Stephen, let's start with the Iran deal. August was a very, very active month. For those of us who were around during most of it, there was a huge debate in the United States, a lot of pressure put on members of Congress by groups like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee to vote against this deal. But it looks as though that effort has failed, and there's even a possibility that there might not be a vote in the Senate on the deal.
Right. Despite this intense debate, I must admit, I don't think I was surprised that the president managed to amass the number of votes in the Senate that would allow him to override a veto if the Senate went ahead.
Sustain a veto if the
Senate went ahead and passed this motion of disapproval of the deal. The interesting thing about it is, I think it's like the second or third time that the president has politically defeated what some people call the Israel lobby or the vehement entreaties of Israel to stop this deal. In fact, in the 2012 election campaign, it was no secret that Israel was, or the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was rooting for Mr. Obama's opponent, Mitt Romney. So I think that's very interesting. And an administration which is often decried for not being very good at the internal politics of Washington has managed to safeguard this deal. So that's very interesting. Now, I think that the thing we have to look to is the next president. Does the next president come in and abrogate this deal? A lot of the Republican candidates are on record as saying they'd do so on day one. To be honest, that's somewhat unrealistic. When the next president sits down, does he necessarily want to trigger a national security crisis, alienate America's allies on the first day of his presidency? That would have a lot of knock-on effects that would affect the rest of his foreign policy. So for now, assuming that Iran and the United States submit to the requirements of this deal, it's here to stay, in the short term at least.
Yeah. Tom, there was a lot of criticism of President Obama. He gave a speech at American University a few weeks ago, which was very, very partisan. He basically suggested that the Republican opponents of the deal had a lot in common with the hardliners who chant death to America in Tehran. And there was criticism. But now, if we look at his strategy, I mean, basically, the Democrats are falling in line, aren't they, behind him, with just a couple of exceptions.
Right, exactly right. One of those exceptions, of course, is the number three Democrat in the Senate, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. But you're right, very few exceptions, and it's quite possible that there will not be a vote in the Senate. Stephen is right. This administration has been notorious for its, how should I say this charitably, inept relations with Congress. Mm-hmm. Many Democrats are more critical of President Obama on Capitol Hill than even Republicans, and we know what they think of him, which is not much. But I think the administration did this one just right in this campaign to get these votes. And I think one of the most important things they did is they brought diplomats from the other signatories
right,
to this
especially
deal.
Europeans, yeah.
Right. They brought representatives from Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, all of whom sat down with many Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill and said, this is the best deal we will get. And if this deal goes down, we five countries will not go along with further sanctions. Yeah. And I think in the end, that really was a powerful message. And I think the other thing is, it just seemed to me that there was not a groundswell of opposition to this deal in the 6 weeks that members of Congress were home on summer vacation. Yes, a lot of Americans don't like the deal, but you got the feeling that the ramparts weren't being attacked by...
Yeah. This wasn't Obamacare.
Right, exactly right. There was not a visceral sort of thing. And so I think those two things changed the calculation.
Yeah, Stephen, also, I mean, we should give credit to the, you know, progressive groups, whatever you want to call them, that mobilized very significantly in support of the deal. You know, they had something called a Schumermobile that went around making fun of Chuck Schumer. They flooded all the town hall meetings of various senators and representatives who had seemed on the fence. And, of course, I mentioned AIPAC, but there's a group called J Street, which represents younger, more progressive, more liberal members of the American Jewish community, and they did a lot of work as well. And so, you know, there's been a lot of sort of, what do you call it, Monday morning quarterbacking, I guess, about the strategy that was used. You know, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, came to the United States back in March, gave this speech before a joint session of Congress, and a lot of criticism of him now for making it even more partisan.
Right, and you mentioned J Street. Their budget was many times smaller than that of some of the other
groups. A few million compared to 20 million, right.
Although, you know, the White House is probably the ultimate lobbying machine in Washington, so they were backing this deal. Yeah, and if you look at it, there's a lot of damage that's been left in the wake of this deal between the United States and Israel. I'd be curious to see whether there's any attempt to mend that in the last 18 months or so of the Obama administration, given the antipathy between President Obama and Mr. Netanyahu. That seems somewhat unlikely. I think it does give someone like Hillary Clinton some running room politically to come in and possibly say she would repair the damage to the ties if she was becoming president. And,
right,
and
even though she
to
supports...
separate herself a little bit from the White House on
even
this.
Even though she supports
That's
the
correct,
Iran deal.
Yeah, Tom?
Well, I was just going to say also that the administration has begun an attempt to repair the relationships. It's widely known that Secretary of State Kerry is working with the Israelis on a new memorandum of understanding, which Kerry says is going to be unprecedented in its support for Israel. They're talking about new weapons.
Sure, another 10-year, right, defense agreement.
Yeah. Right. More sophisticated weapons, including probably the most sophisticated weapon in the U.S. arsenal, the new F-35 stealth fighter. And so the administration, I think, realizes they've got to do something here. We'll see how much of it is real and how much of it is public relations.
Yeah. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz, past and present, and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Steve Collinson and Tom DeFrank. Stephen, we were talking about how the Obama administration might seek to placate the Israelis with more weapon sales, more cooperation of one sort or another. But, of course, there is another country that has been skeptical of the Iran agreement, and that's Saudi Arabia, whose king has paid his first official visit to Washington since assuming that job a few months back, King Salman. What are we likely to see in terms of the relationship with the Saudis? In advance of the agreement, the administration said there would be no big announcements of new weapon systems, but perhaps other things.
Right. I think it was significant that Prince Salman came after the deal was concluded. He didn't come before the deal earlier this year when a bunch of other Gulf Cooperation Council leaders came to the United States. It's almost like he realized that this was going to happen, and he's coming now after the deal to perhaps claim his reward. Eventually, I think we will see more arms deals with Saudi Arabia. Generally, when one of these big deals is announced with Europe, with Israel, you see a deal with Saudi Arabia and other GCC countries coming along fairly soon, although it appears that the Saudis won't be getting the stealth fighter that Israel looks like it's going to get. You know, there's been a very tense relationship between the Saudi royal family and the Obama administration. It's not just over the nuclear deal. The Saudis are very skeptical of President Obama's regional policy. They're very concerned about the what they see as Iran's attempts to establish hegemony throughout the Middle East. So you've got this Sunni-Shia divide that is perpetuated throughout the region. Some people talk about a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Mm-hmm. Whether that is it's quite as clear-cut as that, I don't know. But it's clear that the administration will be talking about the operation in Yemen. Mm-hmm. The Saudis have mounted against Iranian-backed forces there. So it's an interesting time. We've got a new regime in Saudi Arabia. We're coming to the end of a presidency in the United States, so it's a time of flux. But I think you'll see both sides at least try to paper over some of their disagreements, at least.
Mm-hmm. Tom, I did an interview recently with the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Ali Larijani, who was in the United States, and he compared the Saudi attacks on Yemen to George Bush's preemptive invasion of Iraq. He said both were wrong and based on false pretenses. And he also said that the Saudis and others were trying to hide their own problems behind what he called a screen of Iranophobia. I just was curious whether you think that the Saudis are, undertaking a good operation in Yemen, whether their policies in the region are really helping stability or hurting it. And one concern I have personally is that the United States, in its effort to mollify people over the Iran deal, may actually be doubling down on policies that are ultimately not good for the region or for the United States.
Well, it's quite possible, but clearly the Obama administration knows it's got some mending to do in its relationship with the Saudis. The Saudis are nervous. President Obama has dispatched many senior officials to Saudi Arabia to say, in effect, you're going to be fine. We are not hopeless romantics who are Pollyannish about the Iranians. And I don't know whether that's taken, but the talks in Washington are supposed to reinforce that. I think it's interesting, maybe significant, but interesting that the Saudis haven't had a whole lot to say on the public record about all of this. They have not been hammering the White House on the Iranian deal too much.
They accepted it. I mean, their foreign minister gave a statement.
Publicly, publicly. But notwithstanding their public support, they're very nervous about this. And I think that's probably President Obama's main objective in these conversations is to calm down the Saudis. And then we'll see how that works.
Stephen, I was remembering when George W. Bush greeted King Abdullah, King Salman's predecessor, and there's a famous picture of them walking in Texas holding hands. Something tells me that that's not the sort of thing that will emerge from this.
I think you're right. I don't really see President Obama walking anywhere holding hands with another politician in public. I don't think that's quite his style.
Yeah.
Remember, he went to Asia in the very beginning of his presidency and was pictured bowing to the Japanese emperor, and that caused a huge political backlash among Republicans back here. So I think you'd be wary of anything along those lines, and there simply isn't the connection between the Obama administration and the Saudis that there was the long relationship between the Bush
family, sure, and King Abdullah. Yeah, and the Saudis in general.
Thank you for bailing me out, Barbara, because I wanted to make a pun about figuratively hand-holding with the Saudis, but I thought better of it. But I think this explains something almost always when a leading head of state or head of government comes to Washington. There's always a very orchestrated, calibrated, short press conference. The schedule did not include that.
Well, we should remember King Salman is not in the best of health, so right. It's possible that he would not be wanting to face the Washington press corps. One other point, though, about this, and that is, the administration is in a situation where it wants to mollify the Israelis, mollify the Saudis, but the Israelis, of course, are very insistent. The Saudis don't get weapons that could somehow or in some way threaten them. So what I've read is that the Saudis will get upgrades to their F-15s, but not the more advanced models. And also some talk about missile defense and a Gulf Cooperation Council rapid reaction force, various other ways to try to get the Gulf states to work together more closely. I think we're going to move to a topic that has been all over the front pages for the last few days and is likely to remain there, and that is this incredible crisis, Stephen, with migrants, refugees, desperate people leaving primarily the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, although there's some from Afghanistan, other places, streaming into Europe, and some of them not making it. In particular, there was a picture of a 3-year-old boy who perished because his family was put out essentially in a rubber dinghy to sail from Turkey to Greece. European consciences seem to be pricked by this, but what's really going to happen? Who is going to accommodate all of these people?
Right. This picture, I think, really has, as you say, pricked the conscience of Europe, which would basically been trying to ignore this issue. It's got real problems with immigration without a refugee crisis coming along. I think this picture is going to end up being the emblem of this conflict, almost like the picture of the girls doused in napalm was the emblem of Vietnam, or and that man in China, Tiananmen Square, trying to hold back the tank became the emblem of that crisis. It's really a difficult situation. It's beginning to tear the unity of Europe itself. You've got Eastern European countries which don't want to take any of these refugees. You've had the leader of Hungary coming out and saying, we don't want to take Muslims, we're a Christian country.
Yeah.
It's the whole thing is tearing at the fabric of Europe. You've had Germany, which basically says it's going to take as many refugees as it can. And you've got the United Kingdom, David Cameron, who had a pretty tough position that he wasn't going to accept any more refugees than he'd already said he would do, now says he'll take several thousand more in somewhat of a climb down. But the fundamental point about this is that, first of all, no one really knows how to deal with this refugee crisis, and then there's no one's got any idea how to deal with the underlying situation, which is the conflict in Syria that's provoking this terrible flow of humanity.
More than 2,000 people have died just this past year in trying to go from North Africa, from the Middle East to Europe. Refugees and migrants from all kinds of crises and conflicts. The Europeans obviously are bearing the brunt of this, but, you know, the United States could do more. As of the end of September, I'm told the U.S. will have admitted only 1,800 Syrian refugees.
I suspect
1,800.
I suspect in the next month, Barbara, you'll see President Obama announce that there's going to be far more than that, several thousand at a minimum. I think the U.S. cannot be urging Europe to do more when it's doing next to nothing. So I think we will get into the U.S. government will up those immigration numbers. It's a difficult situation for Europe, which has got so many other things on its mind, like the euro currency crisis, the Ukraine problem, which is simmering, but has certainly not gone away, the whole instability in Greece with new elections. And this is the last thing the Europeans need to deal with, but they're going to have to. I agree that there's nothing as powerful as the images of this poor little boy lying on a beach. But the other powerful image is tens of thousands of migrants overrunning the train station in Budapest. The train station in Budapest is the last place tourists and travelers would want to be right now. And the other problem is almost all of these refugees, if you will, they all want to go to Germany because they all know Germany is the most vibrant economy and the quality of life will be there. And thousands of these migrants thought they were getting on trains to Austria and Germany and Hungary, and instead they were taken to two camps. So the Europeans are fragmented, to put it mildly, and they're going to have to do more. And I think the politicians understand they're going to have to do more, but there's a lot of angst about finding a formula that works politically and in a humanitarian sense as well.
Stephen, of course, you remember from your days covering the State Department that the way the U.S. takes people is different, frankly, from this sort of situation. I mean, we do have migrants who try to rush across our borders, as Donald Trump has made clear. But there's a process whereby people register as refugees, and then they go through very, very long and detailed security checks before they're allowed to come to the United States. And I've spoken to Ann Richard, who is the Assistant Secretary of State in charge of this, and she says it's the security checks and so on that make it so slow. Apparently, 17,000 Syrian refugees have been registered and referred to the United States, but so far we've only taken 1,800 because of these checks. Europe is facing a different situation. Obviously, these people are just coming. They're not registered. They're just coming. Tom mentioned Germany. To some extent, these people can help make up for the fact that Europe has an aging population. They need young and vibrant people. And a lot of these people are middle class, and they're coming with skills. But the problem is getting from Turkey, Lebanon, wherever they are, to Germany, to Austria, yeah?
Right, yeah, that's a big problem. And there's the EU law basically stipulates that you're supposed to register as a refugee in the first nation you touch down on. Basically, it's going to be somewhere like Hungary, for example, which has no desire to have these people whatsoever. So Hungary was basically hoping just to kind of ship them into Germany. That's not allowed. What you're going to end up with as the winter approaches in Europe, you're going to end up with thousands of refugees who are basically in camps waiting for the bureaucracy to move on. The other thing is that all these political leaders are acutely conscious that there's a very difficult political situation in Europe already. The Muslim migrant population is a hugely toxic political issue in cities like Paris, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people that don't want more Muslim refugees, however young and vibrant they are and however much they can help the economy, because they just don't want the fabric of their nations, Anglo-Saxon Christian nations, to be changed. So this is going to cause real political headaches for leaders in places like Britain, France, eventually Germany.
Before I go to you, Tom, Britain has taken only a couple hundred
Syrians,
which seems particularly stingy.
And I think the reason for that is because there's this huge political situation. There are already thousands of would-be refugees and migrants camped out in Calais on the Channel coast who keep trying to almost every night smuggle their way through the Channel Tunnel or get across to Calais. So that's possibly the number one political issue in Britain. There's just not a great deal of political bandwidth for a politician to come and say, we need to take more refugees, we need to take more migrants. So I think that David Cameron hasn't been especially articulate in handling this crisis, but it's a very difficult political question domestically.
I think one of the most, if not the most outspoken European leader in opposition to the to this flood of humanity is the Prime Minister of Hungary, who in recent days has said that the migrants threaten Europe's Christian roots. And he also said nobody wants to stay in Hungary, they all want to go to Germany, suggesting that it's not Hungary's problem. And it's suggesting it's not Europe's problem either. And unless he is in a real minority among European Union leaders, it's going to make a comprehensive solution far more difficult.
Stephen, there's a question that has been raised. I don't know if it's premature, about what's called the Schengen Agreement. This is something that went into effect in 1995 and it eliminated the border controls between ultimately 26 countries in Europe. Do you think that this borderless system itself is at risk now?
It's certainly coming under more pressure. There are a number of countries, Britain among them, who are actually not a member of the agreement. Basically, what it means is as soon as you alight in one country in Europe, you have absolute right to go wherever you want to seek work and to live in any country. It was one of the fundamental sort of philosophical underpinnings of the whole European ideal and the whole idea of European expansion. I think this is almost becoming, and the currency issue was along these lines as well, it's almost an existential crisis for the EU that all these outside forces provoking this whole idea of European unity. You know, it looked for 20 years ago, 10 years ago, that this whole idea of history in Europe and some of the terrible things that have happened was all in the past, but all of these issues are now coming up. Nationalism, mm-hmm. the movement of people, refugees are all now in the melting pot in Europe, and it just shows that at times of tranquility and peace, we should perhaps not take them for granted when they occur, because these political and geopolitical forces are still latent in Europe.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention before we quit. There are 2 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, 1 million in Lebanon, 600,000 in Jordan. Tom, there are none in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates. What about the Arab countries that are involved in these wars? Why are they not taking anyone?
Because they know it'll be more internal turmoil. They know it'll be a real drain on their treasuries. Look at how the Emirates and others treat workers from
guest workers
workers who basically paid starvation wages. Many of them die while on construction duty in these countries. I think that's a non-starter for many of the have nations in the Arab world.
Yeah. Well, obviously, this is an issue that we're going to continue to follow closely, but that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal, and Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AllMonitor.com. Thanks for listening.